The number you dialed is not a working number. Please check the number and dial again. Message 3. BAL6.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. From Billy Bomb for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. From Billy Bomb.
A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi, I'm Kyle.
And out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Hi, I'm not Kyle.
We have Gila.
Hi, I'm also not Kyle.
And we have Alex.
I'm not joining in on that. I'm Alex. Hello, everybody.
And somehow you're still clever. Okay, great. We're all here. Can I just say, I just want to stop everything just for one moment, just to proclaim one thing. Pam Bondi is a horrible human being. I'm sorry, I just have to say that. I have to say that over New York City airwaves because it just needs to be said over and over and over again. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, go fire up the C-SPAN archives. Go to YouTube. It's all on there, today's hearings. The hostility, the contempt that she holds towards lawmakers and democracy and freedom and the people and all that. It's unreal. You know, historians of the future, hey, how you doing? Boy, what a time we're living through right now. Please continue to document it. All right. We have a lot to talk about because a lot has been going on. Okay, so you know what the number one news story has been, right? The number one news story, anybody want to take a stab at it? No? Number one?
Let me guess. Is it the social media trials with respect to children and harm to children? Is that one?
Bingo. Bingo. Oh. That is what the top-rated news story should be, but it's not. So who wants to guess? Rob?
Was it about the FBI not being able to unlock a journalist's iPhone?
Oh, that's a damn good story, isn't it? That's a really good story. Very relevant, very much of interest to people like us and, you know, in the media, journalism. Yes, that is a great story, but no, it's wrong. It's totally wrong. Gila, it looks like you might have an answer.
Yeah, and I kind of hate myself for A, knowing this, and
you got
B,
it. You got it.
What I'm about to suggest.
You have it. Okay, go ahead.
Is it Savannah Guthrie's mom?
Yes, you got it 100%. That is what everybody is talking about. Look, I am not in favor of missing grandmothers, of kidnapping, of whatever is going on over there. But for God's sake, people, the only reason that the media is focusing on this is because it's a celebrity's mom. That's the only reason. And I sure hope that they find her and that they bring whoever did this to justice. But I'm also thinking about the many other people who are missing, the many other people who are victims of crimes who get completely ignored. I could list people who are, you know, within 10 miles of where I'm sitting right now, and I'm sure all of you could as well, who have not gotten anything near the attention, who have suffered all kinds of horrors. That said, there is a technological aspect to this story that is of interest to us. And that's why, in addition to focusing on the unfairness of how we choose what stories to cover, that's why we're focusing on it just for a moment anyway. And it's about how Google had played a key role in recovering the video from the cameras at Nancy Guthrie's house. Now, those of you who weren't paying attention, what happened last night was that the pictures and some video from a camera that was not recording pictures or video was somehow obtained by Google, a major breakthrough, they're calling it. And it came down to Google's technical expertise in one of these ass-kissing articles about Google that CNN has printed. The mother of today host, Savannah Guthrie, disappeared over a week ago in Arizona, but on Tuesday, authorities revealed footage of a masked and armed person outside her door on the day she went missing after initially saying the video was not able to be recovered. And the reason there's no video is because, well, they didn't subscribe to the Google Nest service where you pay for that. So, yeah, there should be any video there. Now, engineers at Google, which owns Nest, as we have discussed many times on this particular program, were able to recover data after several days. Can someone first clear up some confusion for me? Because I thought that the doorbell camera was Ring, not Nest. So does anybody know what the difference is?
Yes. Google owns Nest. Amazon owns Ring.
Okay, so does Nest have doorbell cameras as well?
Yeah.
Really? So you could have either Nest or Ring?
I think Nest has a lot of like interior cameras. Ring, you know, has doorbells with the function in it, and I think Nest just has cameras. I think you still have to have a separate doorbell and a camera.
Right.
With a Nest.
All right, fine. Whatever works. The task was so technically complex that investigators didn't know if it would be successful. An FBI official said on Twitter that the Bureau released the images within hours of obtaining them and made a false arrest very quickly after that, apparently, as well. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos initially said there was no video available because Guthrie had no subscription to Google's video recording service. Yeah, bear that in mind, people. You might be kidnapped one day, and if you haven't paid for Google's subscription, you might regret it. But in this particular case, they were able to get past that because apparently Nest still saves around 3 hours of event-based video history for free before being deleted. Aha, you may say. Well, a lot more than 3 hours had passed in that period of time. So how on earth were they able to get that video recovered? Well, hang on a second. Let me finish the story. That data lives in Google's cloud and servers. Even if the data had been deleted from Google systems, it could still exist somewhere and be recoverable because even files slated for deletion can exist until they are overwritten by new data. That's something we all know.
We all know. Garbage file.
Yeah, it's a garbage file. Exactly. Yeah. Except it was really in a lot of garbage because they had to track it down and it's somewhere in the cloud. So, a delete function is just telling the file system to ignore that data and feel free to use that space on the hard drive for new data until it's actually used again. That old data is still recoverable. That's an explanation from the 1980s, which still applies today. FBI Director Kash Patel, I know, but we're going to quote him anyway, okay? Let's just do this. FBI Director Kash Patel wrote on social media yesterday that authorities, working closely with our private sector partners, recovered some video from residual data located in back-end systems. Actually, only two words of that sentence were his words, so it wasn't so bad. Investigators had sent a search warrant to Google for the Nest cameras at the Guthrie residence last week. Such a move is common in a criminal investigation. Basically, they say they had to go through layers and layers of components to make the application work and to figure out just where this video might be hiding. The footage and its underlying data could go through hundreds of thousands of servers, and systems all over the world, increasing the chance of residual data being left behind. All those layers have code, and as data moves around to be processed and made available to the customer, it will move through different layers of sub-applications, sub-servers, sub-storage components. How do you feel about all your images that you do want to save being passed through all of these servers all around the world, hundreds of thousands? And each of these components present an opportunity for data recovery. Now, we don't always want to recover the data. Lots of times there's private information that's being recorded, but yet it's still up there in the cloud. In this particular case, yeah, good thing they were able to do this, but not in every case is it a benefit. So any thoughts on if this is a good or a bad thing? Alex?
Yeah, well, I love that you just call on me. I wasn't raising my hand or anything.
I thought your hand was up. Sure, looked like it.
Yeah, that's fine. Just go ahead, put me on the spot. That's fine. I'm happy to talk about this in great detail. I think that there are a lot of implications here, too, because this notion of residual back-end storage that's recovered from essentially unallocated space but is extraordinarily difficult, and I think Google is being deliberately descriptive about the difficulty in obtaining this data, because what they don't want is law enforcement continually pounding on their door to ask for this particular data over and over and over again, because it could be used in wide-ranging investigations, or it could be subpoenaed by divorce attorneys, for God's sakes, or in civil suits. And Google does not necessarily want to be on the hook, right, for providing this information for any particular case. I mean, they pulled out all the stops here because it's the, as you correctly note, Emmanuel, the mother of a celebrity. So what Google will probably try to do later on is to claim that, well, it's an undue burden for us to do this. We did it in this one particular case because there was a threat to life and it was an abduction case and we were able to do it, but it's not something we're going to pull out all the stops for. If you're just some random person who does not happen to be the mother of a famous person, then, you know, you're kind of, you know, you're out of luck. You're up that creek that we can't talk about mm-hmm. on the air here. So there's that aspect of it too. But then you have this notion of user control over that particular type of data. And there really is none, you know, and all of the dashboards and all of the settings that you can control, you may be able to have some kind of control over how long the data is retained, what is recorded, where it's sent. Maybe if you're lucky, you have access to those types of controls, but you certainly don't have any control over how Google is treating the back-end residual data. So long as they disclose within their privacy policies and their user contracts that they're is a potential that their camera can be recording even when you don't know it's recording, and then that data is sent back to their servers, well, you've agreed to that processing of that data. I think that's problematic here. I think that's problematic, and I think that we should be really wary of the extent to which Google and other services are retaining this particular type of data over time, because obviously it can be recovered.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, somebody could conceivably, if they were concerned about their own data privacy, but they had one of these cameras lying around, they're like, well, maybe I'll get some use out of it. I just won't subscribe to the service, so my data's safe. And it would be very easy and reasonable to think that. And this story proves that, you know, Google decides to still keep a little of your data as a treat. And, you know, there you are. It's the sheer volume of things that depend on the cloud and that run things through the cloud, whether or not you want them, and the cloud being just other people's computers you don't control, it's a really insidious part of our current technological and media environment. And it behooves all of us to be aware of that and to make each other aware of that. I mean, if they'd had some like local security system, which was not a Google thing or an Amazon thing, but just your standard cameras that would record to something in the building or, you know, maybe something offsite that you controlled, they would have all the footage they want. But they would also have complete and total granular control over where that footage goes and how long it stays around.
Would it not be possible, as someone who knows virtually nothing about how this all pieces together, but would it not be possible to encrypt the data before it goes on its journey into the cloud? And then as a default, you know what, just record it for a day. That way, if something happens and you're not a subscriber, you can say, okay, I'll subscribe now. Let me see what just happened because I wasn't expecting that. But you maintain control of it because only you have the password to decrypt the data that was sent up into the cloud. Does that sound reasonable or crazy? Alex, your hand is definitely up this time.
Yeah, I think it sounds reasonable. I think it could be. It would require more processing power because these are video files. So they're larger files. So encrypting them is going to take some non-trivial amount of processing power. But I think even more to the point, you could do that. That would be one kind of privacy-enhancing technology. And another thing that you could do is potentially for all of these files that are stored, if they ever need to be recovered again in a way that makes it easier, you could hash them, you know, have some kind of hash and track which hashes belong to which cameras, and then just recover the file through identification of that particular hash. You know, or maybe those hashes would be stored for a small period of time, like 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something like that. I don't want to give them too many ideas, but because I do think it is, to a certain extent, privacy eroding to have these types of things continually occur. That the devices that we put in our house to answer our doors and whatnot just continually record and monitor us and send that data to a third party for some kind of back-end processing about which we have no control and have no idea.
Well, we have control in that we don't have to put a camera there. But I do think it can be helpful in certain situations, and you never know when that situation will strike. So it's a tough one. It really is.
It's weird to me that, if, as I understand it, they weren't subscribing. I think that's the crux of this. Mm-hmm. Yet it was storing something offsite. To my mind, that seems like, okay, it's dishonesty in what the product's doing, because I might choose something that I don't want to have storing something at a third party or multiple third party places I don't really have control over, but I still want it to function in a way that records, which I think is still a good solution, because running your private residence, however you design it, you could come up with your own strategy to have copies go places or be viewable, but you're not necessarily losing control over it. Mm-hmm. So in the event that there's something in of this level of severity, that stuff can be potentially found and recovered, but within limitations. But I don't know. Just it's this revealing the trust level that we mm-hmm. really don't have or shouldn't have, like a false sense of trust.
Well, I mean, let's say somebody commits a crime and it's their house, but they commit a crime in front of their own camera, but they're not subscribed. Can that evidence be grabbed by Google at the behest of some law enforcement agency and used against them? Alex, I think that's a good question for you.
Yeah, why wouldn't it be? I mean, they're using it in this particular situation. If there's literally nothing stopping them from doing that.
But I'm saying legally, they have the right to do that.
Sure, absolutely. It's a record in the possession of a third party that you voluntarily created. Google can hand that over.
Except you didn't want Google to save it. You explicitly said, I don't want to subscribe to the service being saved. You're saying they can save it anyway and use it against you.
Well, that depends. If when you sign up for the service, you are giving authorization to Google that they can record even when you aren't subscribed, then that's okay. Like, if you've given your consent to having that device on your property and recording it in a way, even if you're not subscribed, then yes, they can certainly hand that data over to law.
Is that in the agreement?
I think it is. I think it has to be in the agreement, because otherwise this would be a big problem for Google if it wasn't in the agreement that they have the right to record even when you're not subscribed.
Yeah, that's the key. Gila, go ahead.
Exactly. And the other thing it was making me think of along these lines is there was an ad on the Super Bowl that people are kind of up in arms about.
That was my next story, the Ring ad, yes.
I'm so sorry, the Ring ad. But I think it's an interesting kind of tie-in here, because this idea of the search party thing, and if everybody in the neighborhood has the same kind of doorbell camera, then we can all search for lost dogs together. Does that not sound utterly dystopian?
Mm-hmm. Of course it does, yes. Yeah.
And
the ad in question, by the way, it was basically a couple of lost dog ads in the Super Bowl, but this lost dog got out somehow, and I guess an alert was posted, and every Ring camera in the neighborhood, you could see it graphically represented, started searching for the dog. And of course, the dog was found and reunited with its owner. So why would anybody criticize this? But apparently a lot of people were upset when they realized, hey, my Ring camera is recording when I don't want it to record and sharing information. And yeah, okay, you can retrieve a lost dog. But you can also track down a dissident this way and all kinds of other privacy horrors.
Yeah. And the whole idea that if you give it a picture, then the AI that's everywhere can look for this one thing. And let's not even talk about where the footage from your cameras might be ending up.
Imagine that you spend millions of dollars on a Super Bowl ad to bolster the image of your company, and you wind up making people want to leave in droves. I mean, that's someone's having a bad week. Kyle, did you have something else?
Sure. I just am imagining, I think that feature was like search party, and it was using, of course, the buzzword AI, right? Everything's got it now. So it uses that and can easily find this shape and size and particular specific dog.
Mm-hmm.
But replace dog with anything, I guess, is the subtext there. And that was, I think, largely a good reaction by people, like just understanding what and how these things are being packaged. And I think that what's being lost is that before these entrants, these tech companies, I think the costs of the components and the pieces and parts both got better and cheaper. But people forget that, like many of these platforms and different types of technology, there was stuff before this. Mm-hmm. and many different types and schemes of camera setups that, without being hosted by one of these large companies, does practically the same thing. In fact, those companies still exist today. And in the back of my mind, I'm kind of laughing, thinking, yeah, right. I can imagine all the little Nest cams inside Google's data centers protecting all of their equipment and stuff. Like I highly doubt that's the kind of platform they run their own security cameras with. And I'm thinking to myself, imagine the crimes that go on within some of these tech firms that we'd love to see all see subpoena and review all of their video camera footage of premises and various protected sites. That'd be such a joy, wouldn't it? And it's the same thing, except these are private individuals versus corporate individuals.
Shall we stick with Google sharing information? Because that seems to be a popular topic. Well, Google fulfilled an ICE enforcement or an ICE subpoena that demanded a wide array of personal data on a student activist and journalist, including his credit card and bank account numbers. That's according to a copy of an ICE subpoena obtained by The Intercept. Amandla Thomas Johnson had attended a protest targeting companies that supplied weapons to Israel at a Cornell University job fair in 2024 for 5 minutes. 5 whole minutes. But the action got him banned from campus. When Trump assumed office and issued a series of executive orders targeting students who protested in support of Palestinians, Thomas Johnson and his friend Mamadou Tal went into hiding. Google informed Thomas Johnson via a brief email in April that it had already shared his metadata with the Department of Homeland Security, as The Intercept previously reported, but the full extent of the information the agency sought, including usernames, addresses, itemized list of services, including any IP masking services, telephone or instrument numbers, subscriber numbers or identities, and credit card and bank account numbers, that was not previously known. I'd already seen the subpoena requests that Google and Meta had sent to Mamadou, and I knew that he had gotten in touch with a lawyer, and the lawyer successfully challenged that, Thomas Johnson said. I was quite surprised to see that I didn't have that opportunity. The subpoena provides no justification for why ICE is asking for this information, except that it's required, quote, in connection with an investigation or inquiry related to the enforcement of U.S. immigration laws, unquote. In the subpoena, ICE requests that Google not disclose the existence of this summons for indefinite period of time. Thomas Johnson, who is British, believes that ICE requested that information to track and eventually detain him, but he had already fled to Geneva, Switzerland, and is now in Dakar, Senegal. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is representing Thomas Johnson. The ACLU of Northern California sent a letter to Google, Amazon, Apple, Discord, Meta, Microsoft, and Reddit last week, calling on tech companies to resist similar subpoenas in the future from DHS without court intervention. The letter asks the companies to provide users with as much notice as possible before complying with a subpoena to give them the opportunity to fight it and to resist gag orders that would prevent the tech companies from informing targets that a subpoena was issued. Your promises to protect the privacy of users are being tested right now as part of the federal government's unprecedented campaign to target critics of its conduct and policies. Agencies like DHS have repeatedly demanded access to the identities and information of people on your services. Based on our own contact with targeted users, we are deeply concerned your companies are failing to challenge unlawful surveillance and defend user privacy and speech. That's according to that letter. Any thoughts on this concern, such subpoenas? Are they legal? Are they not legal? Does Google have more of a responsibility to its users to let them know and not hand over all this private information? Alex, that's your hand.
Sure, I'll jump right in here. I mean, this was also, by the way, an administrative subpoena. So that means that this isn't a subpoena that is approved by a judge. It's not a subpoena that even resembles a warrant in any way, right? Sometimes you have subpoenas that are so ordered by a judge where you have an active case or something like that. Administrative subpoenas are basically just something that comes on ICE letterhead. Like ICE can issue these administrative subpoenas, and tech companies and any entity that houses massive amounts of our personal information, kind of like a dossier on us, should really be very skeptical and look askant at these administrative subpoenas in any context, especially coming from an organization like ICE. I think they have a duty to push back on these. They have a duty to try to narrow them. They don't want to be bothered by doing that because it takes time and effort and money and it undermines their bottom line. They don't want to be on the hook for that, but at least push back in some way on the notice provision so that you could give your users the opportunity to step up before their information is handed over and before you just voluntarily hand over that information. I mean, at least be something of a bulwark. I mean, that's what I find so disheartening here. And that in another sense too, like this is exactly what the administration wants. It's exactly what ICE wants. I mean, this is the system that they want in place. I mean, your Google account has your whole life in it, right? It's got your payment methods in it. It's got your IP addresses. It has your subscriber identities. It's got all the sites into which you log. I mean, it's all sitting there. And it's just one administrative subpoena with ICE's letterhead away from disclosure. You have to understand that. Like, this is not a technical exploit. This is a procedural exploit. And this exploit allows ICE or the government to essentially dox you, to steal your data. There's no patch for that. This is something that can only be solved with legislation. So I think it's particularly problematic. And
I'm sorry, you're going to have to say that.
It's very disheartening that our massive companies particularly problematic and really disheartening.
I think they were trying to silence you there. Let me just ask you a couple of stupid questions, if I may. So administrative subpoena. What does that look like? You say it's on letterhead. Well, who signs it? Does anybody sign it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an ICE officer that will sign it. You know, somebody with authority to issue these administrative subpoenas from ICE.
Are they trying to look like a judge when they sign it? Is there a stamp next to their name?
I don't know if there's a stamp. There's probably, it's got to be on ICE letterhead, but they're just agency issued. There's no prior judicial review.
Could someone forward us an administrative subpoena, please? There are so many of them floating around. I just want to see what one looks like. I want to see if they're trying to make themselves look like judges, see how official it actually seems. Yeah. Who can issue administrative subpoenas? Is that something anyone can do, or only government agencies? How does that work?
Yeah, certain government agencies will have authority to issue administrative subpoenas like this, and ICE would be one of them. Other law enforcement agencies, I mean, sometimes even like, you know, housing related agencies and things will be able to issue administrative subpoenas to require landlords to produce certain records and documents, that type of thing. But it's obviously ripe for abuse, and that's what we're seeing here. I mean, these administrative subpoenas that have no judicial oversight and no accountability mechanisms associated with them are going to be abused.
So
that's what we see happening.
Can anyone just ignore one of these things, or do they have any kind of legal standing?
But they can try to compel. They can try to compel your disclosure there. But generally, you don't have to automatically comply, right? You will have an opportunity generally to narrow or constrain the scope of the disclosure. And we don't see any pushback on these types of administrative subpoenas from the tech companies, as I understand it, and especially based on these stories.
Is it possible they don't know it's an administrative subpoena? Are they labeled on top, this is an administrative subpoena?
I would think that they would know that they are an administrative subpoena, because subpoena processing, especially at any big tech company like Google, Meta, TikTok, et cetera, it's a big deal, right? Like, there are a lot of people that are associated with that particular function because they get subpoenaed all the time for different documents and records. So they would certainly know the difference between a subpoena that relates to an active litigation, a subpoena that's so ordered by a judge, a warrant that's issued from law enforcement that also has undergone judicial review. And I would certainly hope that they would understand the difference between those on the one hand and administrative subpoenas that are issued basically just as a matter of agency practice by agencies like ICE. But maybe I am expecting too much of them. I don't know.
I think now that
I mentioned it.
Yeah, I think you might be, because, you know, in this day and age with the amount of fear mongering that's out there and the way the tech companies have let us all down, I think they could just write a handwritten note saying, hey, could you please give us what you got on this Alex guy who's on the radio? And they'd fall over themselves because they don't want to be on the bad side of Trump or ICE. You know, I don't think it really matters how they ask. I think, you know, they're demonstrating how easily they can be convinced just to turn over all our info. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, and the double talk that Google's doing around this is interesting because, as noted in the story, an attorney for Google told Thomas Johnson's lawyer, Google has already fulfilled this subpoena. Production consisted of basic subscriber information. That's what Thomas Johnson was told about the info requested about him. But as the story points out, this isn't basic subscriber information in terms of like, oh, it's your name and email address. Maybe that's it. No, it's usernames, addresses, lists of services that he was subscribing to. Telephone or instrument numbers, subscriber numbers or identities, the credit card and the bank account numbers, all of that. And as you mentioned, your whole life is wrapped up in a Google account nowadays, down to like where you travel if you keep that info in Google Maps, you know, where you are step by step, minute by minute, day by day. All of that is in there. And all of that is apparently just basic information that Google will drop on a whim.
Wow. We could talk about this all night. And, you know, we have conversations like this whenever we have one of our conferences wherever they happen to be. Enough people have been writing to us asking this question where I feel we should address it. Hope does not have a home. We don't have a conference at the moment for this year. And Hope is also now a 501c3 nonprofit organization, independent of 2600, independent of us. And I just wanted to let people know where we stand. We're going to be talking about this more on Overtime, but we want to have conversations like this. But it's partially because of conversations like this that we got kicked out of St. John's, because it gets a little controversial. It gets a little, edgy. And so many people don't want to have those kinds of conversations associated with them. You think Google are acting like cowards. They're not alone. They're so far from being alone on this. We're seeing so many people cave. We're seeing so many organizations, college campuses especially. I am so disappointed in how they have caved and bent over to do whatever they are told to do by this administration. These are tough times. These are very dangerous times. We are committed here on WBAI to have these conversations, to point these things out, to give our listeners a voice, and to support wherever possible this kind of dialogue. So while it might be a difficult situation right now, we know it's not going to stay that way. And we know that because you're out there and you're supporting places like WBAI. Please support the radio station. Give to WBAI.org. Or go to buddy.wbai.org, pledge whatever you can. Having this place for people to speak out and stand up to oppression, which I think we all can see now, is so vital. You either get your top 40 music or your state-sponsored propaganda, or you get individuals. And we might not always agree with each other, but we certainly have a lot to say and a lot to make you think about. And if that matters to you, if you want to preserve that, please go to that website, support this place, keep it going. We've been on the air since 1960, and we haven't stopped complaining yet because there's so much out there that needs attention drawn to it. And this is, you know, I wish there were 48 hours in the day because there is so much now to devote attention to. And, you know, it feels terrible to see so many things that we were worried about come true, but that's what's happening. That's exactly what's happening. So join us. Keep this place on the air. Make it stronger and support everything that fosters free speech. It is vital. It is so vital. Alex.
And we do speak very freely about all things. And I know some certain people will complain about the political nature of what we talk about sometimes, but I go back to this a lot. You know, look, we don't pull any punches if it's a Democrat or if it's a Republican. We're not one sided. I think we're rather independent on all these issues, and we just never shut up about it. And we haven't shut up for a really long time. And especially this radio show, which Emmanuel, remind me again what year it started.
Well, the first episode of Off the Hook was 1988, but that was a one time thing. And it actually had been preempted once and rescheduled for a nighttime show. So the initial one was 3 hours long because it was a special. We had no idea it was going to turn into a series. That didn't really start until 1991. And then it was a biweekly series. And then shortly after that, it became a weekly series. And the rest is history.
Wow. So 35 years is
There's no need to say how many years it's been. It's just, yeah, it's been on the air for a while.
That's a long time. That's a lot of words on the air here. And look, you know, I think, you know, to bring it back to the story that we were talking about, right? I mean, there's a big contradistinction here. I mean, in that particular story with Google and ICE, I mean, ICE slapped a gag order in that subpoena, and you didn't hear Google saying a damn word about this, right? There, and those gag orders and administrative subpoenas, they have literally no teeth, right? Google did not have to comply with that. Google could have notified the subscriber about this. They chose silence. And when a corporation like that voluntarily adopts a secrecy posture of law enforcement, you have to wonder whose side they're on. You never have to wonder whose side we're on.
Yeah, like you said, we can't shut up. Google had no trouble shutting up.
That's so, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's a good way of phrasing it, of illustrating just what the people affiliated with a station like WBAI are all about, or the various projects that we get involved in. Yeah, people who can't shut up, people who keep spouting forth. It can be a pain sometimes, especially if you disagree, but that's part of the process, and we welcome it all. Kyle, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that, those contributions and keeping the station here and being a listener, just your listenership alone advances so much in society, so much in your world, in our world, and gets the message out to people. If what we're talking about resonates, if you give us feedback, we become better at sharing news stories and giving our own perspective on it. And that is really symbiotic. We don't really know who's out there at any one time, but it is truly an honor and a big responsibility. I think we've taken seriously since way back. And in getting that message out, your listenership, it basically, you become better informed by listening to WBAI. You become someone that people share their perspectives on in your community, and you can put people onto things that you've heard about that might be affecting them in ways they don't even realize. And that is incredible. And what we've noticed in my experience being on the air, and I don't know if the people who have been around longer share this, but what we've noticed with technology, what we've noticed with hacking, with people that are curious about it, that notice the flaws, notice how it breaks, how it doesn't really suit humans in some ways, or how it's really, truly magical and transformative. What we've noticed is that it really pervades all aspects of life. It really affects so many different things, especially as more is adopted and it becomes more capable and something that everybody has experience with so many different types of interfaces and devices and down to software or firms that are managing it all. And somehow people are making it work and jettisoning the things that are cumbersome and flawed. And we want to elevate those observations. We want to share that and get it out. And then your listenership, what I'm saying at its core is that gets it out further to the places that matter, to representatives. When you register your distaste with elected officials, all of that is connected, and that's the metaphor of this computer network we call the internet, that we are really truly connected. So share in that, listen, and give us your feedback.
Yeah, I think you touched upon something really important, that we have no idea who's out there. And that's the beauty of radio. You don't know who's out there. There could be 10 people. There could be 100 people. It could be 1 million people. You do not know, because radio is anonymous. It's passive. You turn on the radio, there's no record of that. You know, on the internet, yes, you can keep track of how many people are there. But the other thing that we have is an archive. And you have no idea how many people are hearing the archive. We're talking now live on February 11th, 2026. But somebody could be hearing this years from now, because we have an archive on our site, which is 2600.com/offthehook, of every show ever made. And boy, there is such history there. So many different things to talk about, but also so many different sound effects of technology, how things used to be. And it's important to document all that. That's what the conversation also does. If we were just talking about exploits and the latest version of Windows or something boring like that, I don't think you would appreciate it as much in the future. However, if you listen to the show decades from now and you tune back onto this era or the era before it, you'll see how things have changed, and you might see how things might change more in the future. So it's vital to document, to save, and to keep listening. And I hope people do. We have another interesting story kind of related to what we're talking about. The FBI has so far been unable to access data from a Washington Post reporter's iPhone. Why? Because it was protected by Apple. Yes, Apple steadfastly refuses to cooperate. Well, actually, no, not entirely. It's Apple's lockdown mode. So when agents seize the device from the reporter's home, Apple's lockdown mode kicked in. They were able to access the reporter's work laptop by telling her to place her index finger on the MacBook Pro's fingerprint reader. I would have placed a different finger in a different position, but I everyone does it differently. This occurred during the January 14th search at the Virginia home of reporter Hannah Natanson. But as previously reported, the FBI executed a search warrant at her home as part of an investigation into a Pentagon contractor accused of illegally leaking classified data. It's really kind of unprecedented. FBI agents seized an iPhone 13 owned by the Post, one MacBook Pro owned by the Post, and another MacBook Pro owned by Natanson, one terabyte portable hard drive, a voice recorder, and a Garmin watch. Government investigators want to read Natanson's signal messages, and were able to view at least some of them on her work laptop. The reporter has said she has a contact list of 1,100 current and former government employees in Signal, which she uses for encrypted chats. The iPhone was found powered on and charging. Its display noted that the phone was in lockdown mode, the government filing said. After the seized devices were taken to the FBI's Washington field office, the computer analysis response team, known as CART, began processing each device to preserve the information that was there. CART couldn't get anything from the iPhone because the iPhone was in lockdown mode. They could not extract that device. The government also submitted a declaration by FBI Assistant Director Roman Rajowski that said the agency has paused any further efforts to extract this device because of the court's standstill order. I'd never heard of that. The FBI did extract information from the SIM card with an auto-generated HTML report created by the tool utilized by CART, but the data contained in the HTML was limited to the telephone number. Apple says that lockdown mode helps protect devices against extremely rare and highly sophisticated cyber attacks, i.e. what the FBI is trying to do, and is designed for the very few individuals who, because of who they are or what they do, might be personally targeted by some of the most sophisticated digital threats. Again, FBI. Yeah, introduced in 2022, lockdown mode is available for iPhones, iPads, and Macs. It must be enabled separately for each device. To enable it on an iPhone or iPad, a user would simply open the Settings app, tap Privacy and Security. Just waiting for people to catch up. Got that? Okay. Scroll down and tap Lockdown Mode, and then tap Turn On Lockdown Mode. Process is similar on Macs. In the System Settings app that can be accessed via the Apple menu, a user would click Privacy and Security. Scroll down and click Lockdown Mode. And now click Turn On. When lockdown mode is enabled, your device won't function like it typically does, says Apple. To reduce the attack surface that potentially could be exploited by highly targeted mercenary spyware, certain apps, websites, and features are strictly limited for security, and some experiences might not be available at all. All right, well, you know, that's kind of a happy note to end on, I think. They can't get everything they want.
Yeah, I go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree as well, absolutely. And it's kind of really great that this is available as part of the stock OS in these things.
Yeah, I would just say, like, has anybody taken a look at their phones and looked at features? I've personally looked at a lot of the features on different devices that I've access to, and. Yeah, a lot of it's come a long way. There's a lot more stuff built in. And I think that, you know, you don't have to be totally going overboard and becoming really unusable in your digital world. But if you've got features that you're not really checking out on your phone that might help you in certain situations, check them out. Try them out. Test them out. See what works for you. There's a lot of ability that is built in now. And it reminds me, I have a fingerprint story, but we'll get back to that.
Do that on overtime. Alex, 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. I think this is...
I'm sorry, Alex, that counts.
...for journalists.
Your frozen time counts.
Sensitive reporting and... Oh.
Okay, we're going to have to continue that later. Yeah, you froze. I'm sorry.
Frozen?
Yeah,
is that
sorry.
It?
Sorry. Yeah. Well, we'll continue this on overtime. But I did want to point out that hackers are breaking into Jeffrey Epstein's personal email accounts after finding passwords in some of the files that have been released in the latest document. There's a lot of fun in here. But if you go to a site called jmail.world, have any of you been to this site? It's you can act like you are Jeffrey Epstein's Gmail. Don't act like Jeffrey Epstein. No, you can be his Gmail user and be able to see who mail was sent to, who mail was received from, and catalog it. jmail.world. I didn't know world was a top level domain. It's a lot of fun for the whole family and a way of finding out more things that are being hidden and obscured. It's fascinating to see. Hey, we are out of time. Join us on Overtime, youtube.com/channel2600. Good night.
I love- Christ, don't you understand? I'm nervous waiting for my baby's plane to land, returning with her family from the Holy Land. Allah, Allah, Christ, don't you understand? I walked, I reckon my brain, I ran. I can't find my people, got this travel ban. I didn't see them pass through the customs gate. I checked the screen and the plane ain't late. The flowers that I bought are beginning to wilt, and the frango mints are turned to chocolate milk. I walked, I reckon my brain, I ran. They got a handcuff to a rail down at Carousel 10. So I gave a shout out to my local DJ. I made a song request, confess my sins to the only friend I got, knows the shape I'm in. Hey, Mr. DJ, help me break her chains. Get your bolt cutters and meet me down in baggage claim.
Off the Hook will be back on WBAI New York next Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Join us now on YouTube on Channel 2600 at 8 o'clock for Off the Hook Overtime.
Well, we would need a diversion before we made a break. I threw myself on the ground and I began to shake. The DJ cut my baby and her mama's chains and said, welcome, pretty ladies, to the USA. The car was at the curb and I threw him the keys. We went to Gene and George Eddie's with the refugees. Mistake about it, we got a civil war. My eyes have seen the cracks in the glory of our lords. Golden showers from golden towers rain down upon us at the midnight hour. I walked, I reckon my brain, I ran. Allah Christ stole our dreams again. The dreams of the daughters and the mothers and the family that you thought you'd never see again. The dreams of the dogs, the Irish and the blacks, the refugees and the immigrants, the dreams of our DJ and his deepest tracks. When your dreams get stole, you gotta steal them back, yeah!